In the finality of it is that it makes it to organise, because they've got to be all over the place and they can't concentrate their attention in one area.
Is this a trend overseas, for instance, in Japan or America? Is this something which is more further developed than it is here, do you know?
Well, I haven't been to those countries, but I think... of tons of iron ore in the Pilbara.
It's a long term.
Oh, definitely.
But feel that's definitely not like they run out of iron ore before it runs out of contracts, sort of thing.
No, that's right.
I see. So it'll be a question of sales.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, let me think. What else have we covered? Is there anything else at this stage you've got interesting to say about the iron ore industry in Europe or your work or whatever?
I think we just flow on and you keep asking me questions and I'll keep trying to answer them.
Yeah, well, I've just... Now, I presume if there's a natural gas industry, you must have offshore gas platforms or drilling platforms or whatever. How does that part of it work?
Well, the current state of play is that there is a major platform operated by Woodside Offshore Petroleum.
How far out?
It's 140 kilometres east-northeast of Karratha and is connected by a pipeline and sophisticated communications systems. There is currently on board approximately 257 people.
How big is it?
It's fairly big. From the base of the platform above the sea, it's 125 metres to the seabed. And it's a fairly large structure. Annualised salary system. They work a standard 12-hour day, and on occasion there's some overtime involved, but not a great deal.
So that's what? How many days a week?
14.
I see. 14 days straight.
14 days straight.
And 12 hours. So they're putting up a quite a lot of work. They're working more than a 40-hour week.
That's correct.
Yeah. But if it were averaged over the 4 weeks, would they be working a 4-hour week? 40-hour week, probably something. I mean, it sounds really good, doesn't it? But when you add up what the hours they're clocking up, 168 a fortnight. They're putting that. Yes, you see, they're not. Then it's they're working slightly more than a 40-hour week if you spread over 4 weeks.
Yeah, well, a rotor is 168 hours a week, a fortnight, but the salary is annualised, and that takes into account that the 2 weeks that you have off are paid for. I suppose if you want to do the equation the other way and say, well, if you had a permanent day workforce working on shore and you spread the hours over 52 weeks of a year and then added in all the public holidays and the weekends and so on and so forth, there's not a great deal of difference in the time on and time off.
Yeah.
And that's one way to run it. I think the practicality that we need to look at there is that it's an isolated platform. It wouldn't be practical to run it in that sort of fashion, and it's isolation from Perth. Yeah,
it's a bit like a ship at sea, isn't it?
In some respects, yeah, it is.
See,
Wendy,
that's what the seamen get. I think they get 6 weeks on, 6 weeks off. You know, sounds great, but they've worked.
Yeah, well, they earn it,
and
I think you were asking, what it's like. Yeah. The workers on the platform have got a phrase that they use, and it's called the golden handcuffs. And that is that, they receive a fairly high rate of pay. For example, a fitter that was working on shore in a workshop, I suppose, in your part of the country, when you're in Geelong or, where I came from down around Fremantle, it'd be fairly unlikely that he could guarantee year in, year out, he was going to earn $40,000 to $50,000 a year. And of course, accordingly, once you get yourself onto a wage structure like that and a standard of living like that, then you've got to keep going to the platform to get it. And how long do you ride the rocking horse on the merry-go-round before you get off?
And yeah, it'd be all right if you just said, okay, when I've got so much money, I'll buy a house in Perth and open a business or something, which was a chap I met in Darlington.
Yeah.
Said just that, and then he knocked off when he was 45 or something.
Yeah.
If you live it up.
Yes.
Yeah. And how do you get? Is there a very big turnover of labour in those jobs?
Within Woodside's operations, there's not fairly sought after jobs and fairly high paid.
And they fly them down to Perth, don't they?
Yes.
Do companies get their own airplanes, or do they?
No, they use the
commercial
airlines. I think there's some real problems associated with that lifestyle. I think it's a peculiar way to live in terms of conducting a family relationship. I think there are real potential health problems. The mind sort of starts to boggle when you start to think of problems like AIDS that really are an international problem now. What do you do when two or three people turn up on the platform who are AIDS sufferers, and the effects of that? And
what's the conditions like? Well, they all sort of, do they have dormitories, or they have private rooms? Is it 250 people is a lot to accommodate on a
They live in in shared accommodation, two to three a room, and that's going to last until such time as this stabilisation program is completed, and then hopefully it'll go back to normal. It's supposed to have gone back to normal 2 to 3 years ago, but because of the work that's gone on with the stabilisation program, and also by the addition of of certain other equipment associated with the production of condensate, what's known as the gas recycling package, has meant that there's had to be more people on board. They live in, so they've had to put extra beds in the room. In the initial construction stages, there were four to a room, and when that was completed, it went back to one and two a room, and now it's back to two to three a room. Now, amongst the contractors, in the main, it's four to a room. They share a toilet and shower with another group of workers who are in another room. So you've got eight people sharing shower and toilet in the contractor's area, and four to six within Woodside's area.
And what they have, all the meals are provided?
All meals are provided on a mess deck.
If you didn't love the food, you'd be in a spot, wouldn't you?
Well, that's dead right. And
so it's institutional sort of mass cooking's mass cooking.
Yeah, it's of a fairly high standard, Wendy.
Yeah.
But people that are concerned about what they eat and stuff like that are in a pretty difficult situation. And in fact, that is an issue on the platform. It's been raised and it's been discussed.
What are the sorts of issues that you come across on the platform? What are the sort of reasons you go out there? Apart from sort of talking to the bosses for general things, what are the concerns of the members of the union?
Safety.
Yeah.
because it is a gas-producing platform, you know, it's a volatile product, and the work goes on, they might concern themselves about certain safety issues. You know, they get raised. The way that workers are treated within the award, there are always questions about that. And because it is a new operation, Wendy, you know, there's lots of things happening with the award, where it's going in the next 2 or 3 years, and there's always issues to be
situations come up where the award wasn't intended to cover those sort of situations.
That's right.
And it's unclear as to interpretation, and the management, I presume, of course, always looking to their own interpretation. It's usual, you know, you've got to fight every issue.
Well, they, you know, the generality of that's right, and the other thing is, because it is an expanding operation and it's a new operation, the award, when it was originally set up, was never set up to cater for that. And so those things are brought on. And then the national wage case decisions that are being brought down, there's always issues about that and they have to be discussed. And
do they flow on?
They do. And people's level of understanding of what those decisions means. You know, the information has to be passed, so their level of understanding will increase. And it's made even more difficult by it being an isolated place, by it being offshore, by being there so many people, by people being on rosters, by people, you know. Whilst we say it's two on and two off, Wendy, not everybody changes out on the same day. So they change out all over the place.
It's
like a group of greyhounds chasing that hare around the track. You know, you can get tumbled real quick.
You might just get something, you know, this, in the union point of view, going, or you might go out there to see someone, and one person concerned is just ready to go off or gone off.
You got it in one.
Yeah, and they don't fly them. Do they fly them into Karratha, and do they stop in Karratha, or do they just fly them? I mean,
You fly by helicopter from the platform to Karratha, and then they board a plane.
So in fact, they don't get much time in Karratha to come and see you.
20 minutes, half an hour. The airport.
So you very well have no real contact with them except on the rig.
On the platform, by telephone. Either when I go out there, or by telephone if I talk to them, or by telephone at home, or if it needs be. We've called plenty of meetings in the past in Perth of workers that have been rostered on and rostered off. On occasion, we have had the workers flown up from Perth to the platform who have been rostered off.
Right, by the company?
And the employers paid for it.
Now, these workers are earning a very great deal of money compared with ordinary workers. Does this tend to make them think more like, a bit less like workers? I mean, I find workers who earn $35,000, $40,000 often don't really live working class lives, or, you know, really, would it make them less, for instance, less interested in the union? This often don't upset us where you're earning well.
That's not an attitude that I've
found.
It's not been my experience.
I suppose, in fact, that the strange conditions of their life and the dangerous conditions of their life would overrule a complacency.
That's right, Wendy, and what do you do? You negotiate a set of wages and conditions. Then the worker receives that, and then he's categorised, and there are people that do it, I suppose, that say, you know, well, they're no longer workers because they receive $35,000 or $40,000 a year. It's bloody impossible. You know, you can be a mental gymnast to deal with that sort of stuff. My attitude is, they are workers, they are members of a union, they're covered by an award, and they receive a certain set of wages and conditions. And if we go back a bit to what we were saying before, if you put that spread of hours over 52 weeks in a fitter in a workshop in Geelong, you receive the same wages and conditions if he worked those hours. So,
well, plus the extra allowances and things he's getting for hardship and isolation, and not any allowances, but
being
fed and all.
Yeah, that's right. And but those things aside, you know, the base wages and conditions are not radically different.
No.
But as you say, the isolation allowances and the platform allowances and all the rest of it do make a difference. I suppose in 10 years down the track, I don't know what sort of union or workforce we're going to have there.
Yeah,
I mean, there is always the danger that they'll all become hotel owners or, own islands off the north shore of Queensland.
How long do they stay? I mean, are they on a contract or is it a...
No, they're permanent. Permanent employees so covered by an award.
People might stay there 10 years, many of them.
They could do. I mean, bear in mind the platform's only been producing since 1984.
So we haven't found out.
But some of those people have been long-term employees of Woodside. I mean, the Woodside have been in the game a long time.
So they've been working elsewhere and Woodside have put them out there. Is there a union organisation on the job? I mean, you've got a convener?
There's shop stewards and there's a structure there and there's health and safety people and, all the unions, various unions have stewards. And
so is there anyone out there on that rig who isn't employed by Woodside or one of its contractors? Is there a government inspector?
No, there's not government inspectors on board. The government inspectors come from the Mines Department in Perth, and they come up and do regular visits, or if there's something special, you can contact them and they can come up. Either the employer or the unions can...
Does the union have any sort of inspectors of its own? I was thinking of Ken's job that he's going to have.
Inspectors in terms of fully employed by the union, no. Inspectors in terms of health and safety reps on the job, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, what's this job? So now you've got these... So those are the three main areas you work in. You cover Parabadoo, Robe, Cape Lambert, Kanawanika. So that's a big area, isn't it? This must mean that spend an enormous amount of time travelling, and this must put big pressures on if you want it here and you want it there at the same time. What's your priorities? How do you respond to all the various demands when it being a one person?
Well, the way I try and deal with it is in terms of some sort of priority. Is that if there's a worker being sacked or dismissed, that takes priority over anything else. If there's a major strike, then that takes a priority. And from there, you just work back down about what meetings are going on, what issues are on, and try and juggle that in between. And then, of course, if you've been summoned to attend conferences, or you've got hearings and determinations before commissions, either in Karratha or Perth or Sydney or wherever, you have to attend those too, so it doesn't lead to any sort of organised approach to doing your work.
Now you've got to respond to immediate situation. This may make it a bit hard to develop a long-term sort of strategy.
Well, I think it's bloody near impossible.
Yeah.
Given the resources.
The trouble is that the bosses are developing long-term strategies. You're responding, one is forced to respond to them because you don't have that leisure to... to sit still and think. It must be extremely difficult. I've just noticed the jobs, the way in which union organisers work here, and it seems to me to be a very, very difficult job for them and exhausting. I'm surprised that you've been here so long. How long have you been an organiser?
I've been an organiser since April 1984.
Oh, it's not all that long, is it?
No, it only seems like 100 years. It's not. I mean, I think that's... people who know, who are active in the union, who are shop stewards and rank and file people who are aware, appreciate the problems. But I think in the main, even employers, don't have any conceptual understanding of how union organisers operate, and or the sphere that they operate in. And I certainly think the vast majority of people within the union and within the community don't have an appreciation of what workers, union organisers, do.
Yeah, it seems to me that you're sort of bits of maids of all work. You're supposed to take an interest in the community, and you're supposed to respond to the workers' demands and travel fairly long distances, which aren't always possible to go by air because of the meeting you've got. Well, notice the meeting you had at Tom Price that day, you just weren't able to get a plane because there wasn't a convenient one, so you had to get in the car and drive.
Yeah.
And this took, all day to get one meeting.
Yeah.
And, or perhaps more than all day, if it's at night or anything like that. And this seems to me, and then, again, of course, you're expected, if you've got ideas sort of beyond that, or you're, in some ways, you're lucky because you're not a family man, but it must, with family people, put a big strain on the, on daddy's, well, it always does when it's in Melbourne or Karratha, you know, daddy's got to go to a meeting, you know, make sure you cope. And it also, then you're expected, and because of, say, things like the extras, like having art and working life programs, okay, that's great, we'd like to show this all back to the workers, but there's no real time allocated for you to do it. So this seems to me that they put on, you know, the union movement has never been a great employer in that sense, in that they expect so much and don't provide the, you know, a fair backup, it seems to me. And I've been a unionist all my life and I've worked for unions, but I've never been able to be great employers.
I don't think it's anything that's peculiar to Karratha or the Pilbara, really. I think, you know, unions have always had those problems, and I think that, you know, I know people that I've worked with in Perth that are now union organisers or work anywhere within the union structure. You know, and after all, they are just ordinary workers that have worked on the tools. They're nobody different or from the workers that work on the tools now, or in within industry, and the problems that they face are of the same magnitude as what they are up here. They're just slightly different here. The questions of isolation and distance between your areas of your population, whereas in Perth there's lots of people in a small area and so on and so forth. I think in terms of unions and as employers, well, my attitude about that is I knew what I was getting into, and I knew it wasn't going to be any hayride, and I don't hold any ill feeling about that. I given the limited resources that unions have, and those resources, after all, are provided by their members. And I say limited in the sense of, for the union that I work for is a fairly powerful union, and by comparison to some others, is a fairly rich union. But then you can't
waste the workers' money.
That's right. You've got a responsibility. It's not my money. It belongs to our members, and you can't go throwing that all around the place. And I think in terms of what the unions in this state have been able to do for the officials in this area in Karratha, you know, providing the wherewithal for us all to move into that joint union centre, you know, is a progressive step. And I think there's more and more progressive steps that have got to be taken. But I mean, overall, that, Wendy, it is a difficult life. It's the burnout rate's pretty high. I think it's probably higher here than what it is in Perth or in, say, Melbourne or Sydney. The pressures on the family life are even far more, because, as you say, you know, if there's a daughter in Melbourne or Sydney who says to her father, the union organiser, oh, he's at a meeting tonight, that means he gets home at 11 o'clock. Here it means that you mightn't see him for 3 days.
Yes, I see.
And, you know, the experience here has been that union officials last one or two terms, and then they either get out of the game altogether, or they go to Perth, or
what's a term?
Usually about 3 or 4 years. In my case, it's 4.
And what do you do? Your union organisers are appointed by the state council, or what?
They can be for short periods of time, but in my case, I am elected by the rank and file once every 4 years.
So
or
that is the AMWU elect organisers.
That's
correct. It's a very democratic system, really, because I know my husband's union, they appoint them, you know, as a member, really, no one, yeah, so we know anything about it.
Yes. It is a democratic system. We do have instances where we may put someone on long term by appointment, and that appointment is not something that's worked out in isolation from the membership. It's something, for example, with Jock Ferguson, who's our organiser on the borough, was placed in that position after long discussions with the rank and file, with members of the branch in Karratha, with consultation with the officials in the area and in Perth, and there are many factors that go to assessing the requirements for an official and for putting an official on in a particular area, and in that case it took some 2 years.
Yeah. Would you? So you haven't. You say you've been covering the borough, but from there, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Jobs, but, yeah.
Well, up until late 1986.
Uh-huh. I see. Well, that'll be. It's now going into a big new stage where it demands another organiser.
That's correct.
But you wouldn't be putting someone. You wouldn't be electing someone for a 4-year term for the job. Probably isn't going to last 4 years. So therefore, you put on someone for comparatively short term.
Well, Jock has been put on for a 2-year period, but who knows what the future holds? It could expand. In my view, there's a requirement for another organiser in the Pilbara on a permanent basis in any event, but that's for the future to decide.
I think I discussed this with you. It's very difficult for union organisers to get on to Robe River property in any meaningful way now that they follow you around and listen to you and say you can't talk to workers. So the union organisation has taken a bit of a thumping in Fitzrobe River. Now, do you see this as permanent?
Well, I suppose Robe River see it as permanent, the company, but my view of it, Wendy, is that, you've only got to look at the nature of the industry, and it's cyclic. It's determined by economic factors in the main that have got nothing to do with Australia. It's got to do with what goes on outside Australia, and the prices for those products, and in fact even the demand for those products, because within the international community the demand for iron ore and its products is lessening. They've been taken over by ceramics, by plastics, by the invention of new products. So I guess by the turn of the century, the high demand of the 60s and 70s for iron ore is no longer going to exist. And
do you think the way that they have behaved, the Fitzrobe River has behaved, or I'm sorry, that the new Robe River management has behaved, is indicative of the fact that they see them as the market as being tougher, they see things as being tougher, so they are in fact getting tough with their workforce, and you see that the workforce has got much room to manoeuvre in this situation of a falling demand? I mean, for instance, how the hell are you going to re-establish the union, any sort of effective unionism in Robe River? Is it going to be possible?
I think it's possible.
Is it likely? You got a strategy? I mean, how are you hoping to operate?
Well, I think that is likely, and I think it'll take 4 to 5 years, and that. With the assistance of the unions and by providing people to work on those projects on a full-time basis, we'll get somewhere. Now we the rank and file in the iron ore industry of all unions has decided that they will place an organiser on the Robe, and the rank and file have paid for that by way of a levy.
Are they there? How long is that going to go on for? A year or 2 years?
Well, it depends how long the money. There's been a levy struck and been paid, and that money will be used to pay for an organiser elected or picked or selected for that particular job.